an English-Scottish engineer who spent much of his life troubleshooting in major British engineering projects such as London's tube system and the manufacture of aircraft during World War I, C.H. Douglas, once observed that a problem, correctly stated, is already half solved. It could only come from such a person as he, for the essence of good troubleshooting is understanding the problem. A classic example of this might be observed in what is called overproduction of food in a world in which millions may be starving. Even in the richest countries, many, such as elderly pensioners who have to pay rent for their dwellings, have diets which are clearly well below desirable levels. Yet it's a fact that in this same world, restrictions have been placed on the amount of wheat one can grow. In the name of orderly marketing, egg production has been subjected to quotas. Thousands of square miles of fruit trees have been bulldozed, and almost all foods at some time have been overproduced. Take the newspaper headlines, "Worldwide Wheat Overproduction." If we correctly state the problem, we should change that headline to read, "Worldwide Wheat Under Consumption." In this way, because the problem has now been correctly stated, if that is the correct situation, then the solution to be applied is entirely different. For if the problem is under consumption, but we misname it overproduction, then the solution applied is to limit production so that the surplus disappears. This removes the evidence of the problem, not the problem itself. If the problem is indeed under consumption, then we may need more production. But what is lacking is a system of distribution to those who need those products. By neglecting this, the problem will increase. The motivation in directing the following two segments to a discussion of the problem is not negative. It is certainly not done in order to depress, demoralize, or frighten anyone, but rather to attend to the first half of the solution. At this stage, we'll not attempt a total restatement of the various problems. We'll be directing your attention to the magnitude of some of the major problems confronting society today, and which tend to undermine the freedom potentials of the people of the world today. The message of the coming segments is not inspiration, but challenge. It's not meant to provide ultimate solutions, but initial recognition and definition of some of the problems which are the enemies of a free society. It's important not to be overwhelmed by the problem or to become so preoccupied with it that morale and enjoyment of life are lost. We must be sustained by the knowledge that the integrity of truth must ultimately overwhelm all falsehood, and the individual committed to the service of his fellows will triumph. Those who are unduly depressed by problems are granting those problems a reality beyond their due. Just as darkness flees before light, so do problems before the application of solutions. Smallpox, a problem which ravished Europe, taking millions of lives, has been completely banished from the earth, outside of laboratory specimens. So please, be of good cheer. There's no need to despair at the problems before you, because even though the solution may now be a mystery to you, you can have faith that the solutions for man's greatest problems are available. We believe that all the problems raised by the school have specific antidotes which you will be able to recognize and apply by the time you end the school. Those who are deeply moved and disturbed by a problem may well be those who are prepared and ready for the answer. Since the beginning of recorded history, there have been some 22 or 23 great civilizations. They're varied in many ways, but they have all followed a similar pattern. Economically, the first period was one of pioneering, trying to provide the necessities of life, food, clothing, and shelter. This period allowed very little time for cultural pursuits or for enjoyment. It was simply a struggle for survival. As security was achieved, people were able to expand their activities and to associate together to achieve things which individuals on their own could not achieve. Thus, civilizations developed and blossomed. One of the dominating problems right throughout has always been how to share power and how to enforce the rules that are necessary so that people can live together and enjoy some sort of freedom. In many of those early civilizations, power was simply enforced from the top. A king or an emperor or a chief, surrounded by some sort of power in the form of an army or a bodyguard, forced his rules on the ordinary people. If he was benign, life was less grim than it might have been if he was dictatorial or ruthless. But whatever form it took, that type of power restricted freedom to a large degree. The whims of the ruler were imposed on those who were subject to him. Fortunately today, amongst the peoples of the world, there's an almost universal demand for democracy, rather than an imposed rule from the top, which operates without the consent of the governed. As the popularity of this course testifies, even in the more highly developed democracies, the demand for a further decentralization of power back to the individual is growing. History records that each of these civilizations reached a point where, instead of continuing to expand, they began to decay. Long periods passed before the evidence of that decay became obvious. Nevertheless, the path changed from an upward one to a downward one. The process of decay gradually accelerated until finally the remnants of that civilization disappeared to be replaced by another. Very little is known about some of these civilizations. A few relics in the forms of shards of pottery or old buildings tell us that they once existed. Without a detailed written history, we are unable to tell how they live or what problems they faced. Yet there were other civilizations of which a great deal has been recorded. We know much about the Roman civilization. Its similarity to what is happening in the Western world now is nothing less than startling. On August the 23rd, 1976, Time magazine commemorated the 1500th anniversary of the final collapse of the Roman Empire. In that same year, the United States was celebrating the 200th anniversary of its birth. The writer drew attention to the signs of decay evident in both civilizations. Indeed, the similarities are alarming. He said, "The echoes of the old world and this one are chilling. In the final days of the empire, military catastrophe drained the national morale and the public treasury. Inflation grew rampant, unemployment burgeoned, and citizens complained about the inequities of the imperial tax structure." Salvian, a 5th century presbyter of Marseille, complained that taxation, however harsh and brutal, could be less severe if all shared equally in the common lot. But the situation is made more shameful and disastrous by the fact that we all do not share the burden together. The consequence, observed Grant, the Time correspondent, was that thousands of disaffected peasants and slaves went underground. These guerrilla groups, he reasoned, were the equivalent of today's dropout terrorists, likewise thrown up and thrown out by social systems they find unacceptable. Corruption infected a swollen bureaucracy and licentiousness became the order of the day. The massive salons of the American towns are versions of Petronian ritual. Penthouse and Hustler magazines proliferate on New York newsstands. Pompeii also had its pornography, memorialized in frescoes. In the end, Rome suffered more from a failure of its collective imagination and spirit than from barbarians and civil strife and debt. The empire that built the ancient world's greatest roads, that created the profound system of laws that gave the world a culture and language and a sustained peace, succumbed at last to a deficiency of energy and will. Reflecting on the collapse of Rome, Edith Hamilton, one of the most eminent classical scholars of this century, observed, "It's worth our while to perceive that the final reason for Rome's defeat was the failure of mind and spirit to rise to a new and great opportunity, to meet the challenge of new and great events." We're lucky to have a number of Roman historians who gave us a detailed picture. Men like Cicero and Salvian, Tacitus and Josephus, have given us a graphic picture of the decay of a civilization which at one stage had reached right across the known world. The first signs of decay were caused by government itself, which changed its role from being the umpire who oversaw the rules to being a solver of human problems. In order to do this, it had to enforce its will, and so it began to tax more heavily. The first to suffer were those least able to bear it: small families, small farmers, those who had no great stake economically. The result was that thousands and thousands of Roman small farmers were replaced and driven off the land. The government of Rome actually introduced reconstruction schemes which they called the latifundia. What were previously small privately owned properties were expanded and amalgamated into huge tracts. Slaves were imported and put to work. Now, production became the only criteria. The fertility of the soil was neglected. The fertile areas ultimately became unproductive. These were the equivalent of the collective farms of the Soviet Union. They too were unsuccessful. Yet once the peasants were ruined by debts and taxes, there didn't seem to be any alternative but to keep the system going. Those who were driven from the land joined the unemployment queues. Large numbers of unemployed were recorded throughout Rome. They had to be sustained, and while there was no modern dole system, those who could not find work were fed regularly at various points in the cities. They were given free bread and meat, and occasionally wine. They became more and more restless. Colosseums were built, where sports were put on for the entertainment of the masses. These became more and more spectacular, and also more brutal. Their chariot races are still well known today. Gladiators fought each other to the death for the entertainment of the crowds. Life became cheap and had relatively little value. The bureaucracy in Rome had to cater for more and more problems which it had created for itself. Government therefore became bigger and bigger. Taxes soared and inflation became a perennial problem. Various panaceas were attempted. Wage and price controls were introduced. A new type of money based on gold was introduced at one period, but the problem was never solved because the basic cause was never tackled. That cause was the accumulation of power into too few hands. As the security of society began to disappear, there was more confusion and cynicism. The basic spiritual foundations, the central inner ideas with which the empire had first been undergirded, began to be questioned. Norms of morality disappeared. Divorce became a major problem. Children were abandoned, and abortion was a common practice. Homosexuality was rife. Military power and defense forces began to decay, yet a small, rich elite argued that the great Roman Empire could never collapse. The phrase, "it can't happen here," was echoed 2,000 years before we hear it here today. Even Rome had a drug problem. Drugs were brought in from many parts of the world, and this ultimately produced a revolt amongst young people who, as one historian records, dressed in outlandish clothes, painted their faces and their hair in different colours. It can easily be seen that there is very little difference between what was happening then and what is happening to many thousands of our society today. Ultimately, the great empire collapsed, not so much from an outside force as from its own internal dissension, and became a relic in the annals of history. Is it possible to pinpoint one specific cause of the collapse of such a great empire? Probably not. It was a complex degeneration that took place over a span of centuries. Nevertheless, I believe it's possible to see that there were root causes which we need to understand today. There are two fundamental factors. Firstly, it's impossible for any society or any association of individuals to work together and to benefit from that association unless those involved agree upon the rules. It would be impossible to play a game of cricket unless the players agree on the rules. This is all the more true in the complexities of human society, which cover economics, politics, and cultural association. Broadly, the rules which people accept in order to benefit from their associations are derived from spiritual concepts. These spiritual concepts are the central ideas of a people and individuals who sustain a culture. There has never been a civilization that did not have spiritual fundamentals undergirding its law and its cultural associations. Unless people believe that they are both collectively and individually fulfilling a central idea of importance, the relationship between what is within and what is without is lost. Secondly, the centralization of power is fatal. The process begins to break down when one individual or one group of individuals, believing that their concepts are superior to those of their fellows, accumulate enough power to impose their will over that society. They may do so with the noblest of intentions. They may do so with considerable self-sacrifice. They may do so while at the same time leading exemplary moral lives. Nevertheless, the belief that one is entitled to impose one's own norm over fellow citizens by the accumulation of centralized power is the ultimate form of corruption. Therefore, the famous statement by Lord Acton that all power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely seems to be confirmed by the events of history as a natural law which applies at all times. The only alternative is to ensure that power is decentralized into as many hands as possible, that the role of government is circumscribed and limited, and that as many decisions as possible are made by the individuals themselves, provided they do not infringe upon the rights of others to do likewise. If one accepts, therefore, that power does corrupt, then while modern parliaments and politicians are corrupt, simply replacing them with others in the same environment is not going to improve the situation. A limit to power is necessary. Before change can be effected, it must be accepted that a parliament can make too many decisions, make too many laws, and that it can involve itself in areas where it has no business. Those who argue that they could do better if they were in power in the same circumstances are simply deceiving themselves and those they seek to persuade. The emergence of a just democratic system. The lessons of Rome were not lost in Europe and Britain, and for a long period they grappled with what they'd observed. Rome had extended right through Europe and the known world. What had happened was not lost upon those who lived there, and so an intense struggle broke out following the collapse of the Roman Empire to rectify the mistakes that had been made. Gradually it was perceived that power itself must be dealt with before anything else could be solved. This did not happen immediately, but organically, and over a period of history. There developed in Western Europe a new type of society. This resulted from the lessons learned from the collapse of the Roman Empire, and as a result too of the teachings of the new faith, the Christian faith, which dealt extensively in its teachings in the New Testament with the nature and corruption of power and the way to solve it. Out of that society came rights for the individual, a legal system which was there to serve rather than to control, governments which were restricted, kings whose powers were limited, parliaments that were responsible to those who put them there, constitutions which limited the role of government, and concepts that were based upon the premise that beyond all else, power itself must be restricted if a satisfactory society is to be achieved. In short, the age of government by consent had arrived. The result, although many mistakes were made, was to produce a new civilization which, at its height, was less tyrannical, less corrupt, and more enlightened than any of those which had preceded it. It extended from its home in Europe virtually throughout the world. For a long period in history, it offered security, scope for imagination, and growth. The nature of that society will be dealt with in the lectures that follow, and the lessons, which could be applied today, drawn from it. Nevertheless, are the seeds of decline now rooted deep in our own society, as they were in the latter stages of Rome? There is rather too much evidence, unfortunately, that this is so. Basically, this is not to argue that society itself, in its original concept, was wrong, but the spiritual rules which undergirded it have been increasingly either forgotten or deliberately abandoned. Like Rome, noblemen have warned us of what is happening. In each country in the Western world, some statesmen have tried to warn the people of what was coming. Their message, which we will quote from shortly, is not a happy one. Parliaments are breaking down and are no longer properly functioning. One of the great principles which produced parliamentary democracy in the Western system was the individual responsibility of the members who had been elected. Debate was to be open and based on conscience. It was to be recorded in documents to be made available so that people could know what their parliaments were doing. This has gradually been replaced by secret debates, which no longer take place in the parliament, but in the party room. The decision is already made before any debate in Parliament itself. Thus, political parties, which started as a means of association for those who had common principles, have changed dramatically. They now rob the individual member of Parliament of his right and duty to vote on conscience. They help to accumulate power and corrupt the democratic and constitutional system of representing the electors' will, which they falsely claim to uphold. The warnings have been many. A retired former clerk in the Federal Parliament House in Australia, Mr. Frank Green, warned as far back as 1965. With increased party organisation and discipline, the initiative of the private member has gone. It has divided Parliament into two disciplined forces. A major force whose primary objective is to keep the government party in office, and the minor force whose aim it is to discredit it and replace it. Because the opposition will seize every opportunity to discredit the government party must swallow its objections to government policy and support it, abdicating the duty of frank and candid criticism. The debate is unimportant because whatever is said that the division will be on party lines is well understood. But there is a deeper implication, the futility of modern party debate in itself. Neither party is anxious to discuss the issue fully, for fear such discussion would reveal its own divisions. In 1988, an Australian Liberal Member of Parliament, who had just lost his party endorsement, was reported in the papers as saying, "Australia is in a dark period. Parliament is almost irrelevant in the decision-making process. Parliamentarians rarely participated in meaningful debate. Rather, it was an executive, a non-elected elite, which set the political agenda." He said, "The government is just another big business, which can be taken over for a few years and then handed on to someone else to manage according to some narrow corporate philosophy, which has little to do with the way people live their lives or see themselves." The former New Zealand Prime Minister, Sir John Marshall, gave this graphic warning. "The concept of the welfare state has become firmly established and almost uniformly accepted. With that development comes the need for governments to take more and more of the national income to maintain it. That in turn leads to governments taking greater powers to control the economy which produces the wealth needed to feed a welfare state. As power accumulates in the hands of the state and those who carry out the functions of government, so the area of freedom of the individual citizen becomes more and more prescribed, limited, controlled, and restricted. As the functions of the state expand, so the complexities of administration grow, and the laws and regulations and order which those who act for the state believe they require grow in number and complexity too. The accumulation of power and the proliferation of laws demands that excessive power should be curbed, and legislation giving such powers should be subject to the closest scrutiny. The great parliamentarian, Edmund Burke, last century warned what would happen. Whenever Parliament is persuaded to assume the offices of executive government, it will lose all the confidence, love and veneration which it has ever enjoyed. Whilst it was supposed to be the corrective and control on the acting powers of the state. This would be the event, though its conduct in such a perversion of its functions be tolerable, just and moderate. But if it should be iniquitous, violent, full of passion and full of faction, it would be considered as the most intolerable of all the modes of tyranny. Burke foresaw that if ever Parliament moved from its role of being a watchdog on the executive, the cabinet, and become simply an extension of the executive, then it would fall from public confidence and pervert its true function. The Canadian constitutional writer John Farthing said this of his country: "It is in fact true that we in Canada now possess but the empty shell of a constitutional democracy, bereft of all sense of governed authority and reducing all to the level of mere power politics. Our national affairs are now determined by the secret deliberations of ministers who present to Parliament and people on a tiresome succession of fait accompli, all to be justified by counting votes on a single day in every 1,825. Sir Arthur Bryant, the brilliant and most read British historian in the 20th century, who died in 1985, gave this graphic warning as the way he saw things. "This country, and others with us, may revert to the only other form of government known to history, and compatible with human nature, an autocracy of some kind or other, Marxist or otherwise. As a people, we are drifting, and a large and possibly major part of a whole generation is growing up without moral purpose, without discipline, without the will to work or the ability to concentrate, and without standards of behaviour, craftsmanship, or even elementary reasoning." The creed of egalitarian levelling down, seedy permissiveness and welfare state mass pauperisation, which our fashionable socialist and so-called liberal idealist mentors have so long advocated, is depriving our society of the means of its own preservation and regeneration. The English journalist and commentator Peregrine Worsthorne wrote this: "Nothing is so notable about recent political developments in this country than the extent to which the power and authority of the bureaucracy and the trade unions have vastly increased, and the power and authority of parliamentary government has sensationally decreased. So ubiquitous nowadays are the operations of the bureaucracy, central and local, and so absolutely dependent is almost every social, economic and even cultural activity on the cooperation and support of civil servants, that their strangled hold on society is even greater than that of organised labour." These graphic warnings started with that of the great English parliamentarian Edmund Burke last century. The 20th century has certainly been the most violent and one of the most damaging, brutal and calamitous centuries in the history of mankind. It's been a century which has never been at peace. Three great calamities took place during the first half of the century: two world wars, which killed tens of millions, and a depression, which reduced hundreds of millions to starvation and poverty. The second half of the century heralded in a period of financial catastrophe, with debt worse than anything man had ever seen. All nations suffer now from a debt. Nobody seems to know how to solve it, but nations believe that they can shed their own share of the debt by working and producing harder and then exporting the result to others, who are hoping to solve their problem by doing the same thing. The concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands is enormous. Just under one half of the world's production is now owned by fewer than 400 companies. These are continually being reduced through amalgamations. The communist bloc, the industrialized West, Japan and the Third World are struggling with debt on a scale never before seen. incorrect or wrong solutions are part of the problem. Solutions in the form of some sort of world government are openly proposed. The result for the individual would be a situation where no ordinary individual could influence government, and future security would be an unknown quantity. Young people leaving school are no longer able to look forward to a life which they can plan and which they know they can achieve. Many live increasingly from day to day. Many basic spiritual principles that undergird our nation are challenged. For example, rules such as business ethics and one's obligation to pay a just share of tax are questioned, and nobody quite knows where the line is drawn between what is right and what is wrong. It is in this situation that we must find a small body of people who can provide a lead back to truth and sanity. The challenge is enormous, but the prize is great. Can it be done? I believe it can, but it needs the participation of those who care